Welcome back to the second hour of It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Coplin. It's time for this week's in-depth interview with a special guest from the arts. And now, here's your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Coplin.
Welcome back. And if you're a new listener, I'd like to let you know that this is a two-hour show in which we try to explore whether we have more in common than divides us. In the first hour of the show, we ask questions that matter, avoiding politics, instead focusing on the issues that underlie politics and current events, issues that affect us all, young or old, locally and globally. And then in this, the second hour, we balance the creative with the intellectual by featuring in-depth interviews with local, national and international guests from the arts. And the show combines a debate topic with an arts interview because I feel discussion and creativity are two of the most vital ways we engage with the world. It's all a question of balance. And if you'd like to find out more information about the show, you can go to the website, itsaquestionofbalance.com. You can hear podcasts of all the past shows there, and you can connect with me on social media, should you wish, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, etc. So again, the show website is itsaquestionofbalance.com. Well, this week, as my special guest from the arts, I'm really pleased to be interviewing entertainment industry veteran Tarquin Gotch. Starting out as a tour manager, Tarquin became a music publisher before joining Arista Records as an A&R executive, where he was soon promoted to head of A&R, overseeing and or signing acts like Simple Minds, the Thompson Twins, the Stray Cats, The Beat, Elaine Page and Rowan Atkinson. Progressing to WEA, he helped bring success in the UK to Prince, Madonna, Shalimar and many other American signed acts in the WEA stable. Moving into music management, he oversaw the careers of many bands who were successful both in the USA and the UK, including The Beat, Stephen Duffy, The Dream Academy, Hugh Harris, General Public and XTC. He also managed John Lord, founding member of Deep Purple, until his death in 2012, and actor and singer Jimmy Nail, and currently manages Brian Johnson of AC/DC. Meeting the film director John Hughes through his friend Kelly LeBrock, Tarquin acted as music supervisor for most of John Hughes' films over a seven-year period, including Some Kind of Wonderful, She's Having a Baby, Uncle Buck, and Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, as well as supervising some of the music for the hit TV show The Wonder Years. Tarquin has a music publishing company called Not Them Again Music. After being asked to run John Hughes' film company in the 90s, Tarquin executive produced Curly Sue, Dutch, Only the Lonely and Home Alone. He then worked for Fox, running their movie division, Fox Circle Productions, where he oversaw the production of nine TV films, including FBC's highest rating movie of the week, The O.J. Simpson Story. He has since produced both film and TV and currently is executive producing the documentary series Cars That Rock with Brian Johnson for Quest in the UK and Discovery in the rest of the world. Welcome to the show, Tarquin.
Hello, Ruth.
Thanks very much. You're calling us from the UK. Appreciate you doing that.
It's a pleasure.
So your whole life has been in the arts. I'm wondering if you can remember the first art of any kind that had an impact on you when you were young.
Well, that's a tricky question. I suppose it would be the music business in the UK. Pop music. Which at that time, you know, music was sort of central to our culture, whereas now it's sort of drifted off to the periphery. When I was growing up, if you had any pocket money, that's what you would go spend it on.
Right.
Whereas now, of course, kids spend it on tech instead.
Right, yeah. Well, they're spending it, well, I say spending in inverted commas on music, but of course a lot of that means not spending money, just acquiring it for free in this.
Well, no, I'm fortunate enough to have an 11-year-old son and a 14-year-old daughter, and really what they want to spend the money on is the iPhones and the computers and the games, and you know, it's technology that really impacts their lives and connects them with their friends. And music, well, yes, they listen to it, you know, but it's not central to their self-image in the way that when I was growing up, you know, whether you preferred the Beatles or the Stones just was crucial on the playground. Now it's, you know, have you got an iPhone 5 or 6?
Huh. Well, that's interesting. I mean, I think my experience of the young people I know, my own boys, is that they are very engaged with music, but it is part of a range of things, as you say. You know, they are also texting and Snapchatting and all those other things. So I think I get what you're saying. When you were growing up, it was just really the centre of your world.
That's right. And the sort of the equipment sort of reflected it. I remember, you know, the size of your speakers was, you know, incredibly important. And now they listen on the little iPhone in this sort of tinny thing. My daughter will hold the iPhone to my ear, and I'm supposed to, and I'm like, this is how I'm, people have spent hours in studios creating a fantastic sound, and what you're really hearing these days is a sort of little tinny high-end sound. Things have moved on.
So for you, when you were young, music was the thing that really impacted you, as opposed to books or art or whatever. That was the art that really got you, was music.
Well, I suppose so. I was very lucky. My mother worked in a bookshop, so I had an awful lot of books, and you know, had pretensions to being an intellectual. Uh-huh. I still do. You know, growing up in England in the sort of 60s, it was a fantastic time. It was great, you know, and there was cinema, and it's kind of sad, I suppose, to see these art forms suffering. Books not so much. Books are weathering the storm, I think, quite well, but cinema, I think, may go over the same cliff that the music business went over.
Hmm.
And in fact, we are seeing it in that cinema is not culturally as important. You know, you don't look to cinema to make statements about our world in the way that we did when we were growing up.
Hmm.
That role is much more being taken by television. You know, I mean, that's where the best writing and the best sort of storytelling is going on. And cinema, sadly, is, I think, rather like music, moving to the periphery.
Right. I mean, part of that, because of the dynamics of the business model having changed, the risk factor has to be reduced as much as possible, which means that you're not getting such original or risk-taking content in film and music, I would say, in the mainstream, and perhaps that's affecting people's enthusiasm. You know, I mean, the edgy stuff is not in the mainstream anymore, is it?
That's right. But even, you know, I look for it on the edges, you know, and it's, you're not even seeing it there. The singer-songwriters, the protest songs, they're hard to find, and the films that sort of change our view of the world, not so much. You're not, you know, it's hard to find them.
Yeah. I think that...
No,
you go.
Well, partly, I think, you know, with all the filmmakers I know, you know, there's a weariness from trying to make a living at making films and just finding it so hard support their families and live a life, and in the end you sort of migrate away to where you can at least pay the mortgage, and that's why there's this relentless drift to television.
Yes, yeah. No, I think it is really difficult, and I've had some really great documentary filmmakers, makers of The Invisible War, which was put up for an Oscar, about sexual assault of women in the military. And, you know, there's some people really addressing some good issues, both in nonfiction and fiction, I think. But often those people are challenged, like you say, to have to do something else as well to make money, you know, as well as...
To have a day job, that's right.
Yes, yeah, even at that level, you know, it's amazing.
I was talking to a German film director who I loved and, you know, tried to make films with earlier today, and I said, you know, I've given up on trying to make films, and he said, no, I hear you. He said, I can't even, you know, I find the film festivals sort of... impossible. And I thought, oh no, you know, because film festivals were so great. You really went to them with, you know, and got excited about what you were going to see and spend days in dark rooms and loved it. and if they're sort of, again, moving out from the center of our culture, it's a shame. I mean, some things are moving in, you know, the blockbuster, art shows have really come into their own in the last decade in the way that they were 100 years ago. You know, everything is cyclic and there's nothing new. Music business is back to the sort of hit singles of the 50s.
Mm.
And you know, art shows are now blockbusters in the way that they used to be in the Victorian times.
Hmm. Yeah, it is interesting how things are cyclical.
Well, yeah.
Going back to music, I was interested, what drew you to music professionally to start with? You started being a tour manager. I'm just wondering, you know, how did you go from an aspiring intellectual who loved pop to actually becoming involved and working in the music industry?
Well, I was not academically gifted and hated school. I was growing up in the 60s where everything I was reading was about, you know, pursuing your dreams and trying to be different and to move away from the establishment. And so the music business was a natural choice. And show business generally, I worked as a stagehand in the West End, and it was because it was the only place where I could get a job. You know, I wasn't going to get a job in a bank or an accountancy firm because I didn't have the academic credentials. Later, when I was on tour with bands and would play universities and realized that really they were just places where boys could meet girls, I kind of wished I'd gone. But at the time, I thought that, you know, I thought they were serious places, and I didn't want that. I wanted to be on the road. I wanted to be living that alternative culture. And I hope I'm not going to shock your listeners, but, you know, I was smoking dope, and that was part of that whole 60s culture. You just wanted to live a different life.
Yes, yeah, I can understand that. Well, if you just joined us, you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Coplin, and my special guest from the arts this week, entertainment industry veteran Tarquin Gotch. We're going to go to some messages now, but we'll be back soon.
The music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland. Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Ocean's black, but steam lane. No white horses to play the game. About you in the rain. Did I or didn't I say it's forever? Well, I know I said it, babe, it just goes nowhere. It's, well, we can do things we
It's a Question of Balance music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Ciao, I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made desserts in a friendly family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Daniel and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito!
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts, Tarquin Gotch. And I wanted to ask you, Tarquin, being head of A&R at Arista and working at WEA at the time you did, must have been an exhilarating experience, I'm thinking. Lots of big personalities. I was wondering whether maybe a background in psychology might have been helpful.
It would have been, but it was, again, it was, you know, music was central to our culture. What made it onto the big TV shows was important to people, and you really felt that you were sort of involved with society, and it was, yes, it was lovely. It was fantastic, and I got to travel, and I got to meet all sorts of interesting and bizarre people.
Yeah. Can you share some of those bizarre experiences?
Well, I mean, you know, it goes from, you know, when you look back on it, I worked at Arista, and, you know, I went to meet Clive Davis in New York, and, you know, a talented man, and he taught me a lot, and I walked into his office, and there he was. Every week he got the top 40 mm-hmm. Singles, and he just sat there and listened, you know, put them on and listened until he wasn't engaged, and then he took it off, next one on. And he literally, you know, and he talked me through it, and this is what I do, and you know, I was obsessive myself in doing the same, in listening to new music and seeing if it grabbed you. And it's a great way of sort of hearing whether the people making the music are thinking about you, the audience, and making it easy for you. But at the same time, he handed me his biography, you know, and that sort of, there were so many lessons there, the ability to sell yourself. Richard Branson was very much the same from Virgin, you know, an incredible ability to sell yourself. And sort of being a bit British, I always felt that sort of pushing yourself forward was sort of not quite the done thing. Mm. And that was a terrible mistake. And if there are any young businessmen or women out there, push yourself forward. Don't be embarrassed. Get on with it. In the sense that they would claim, you know, A&R people would claim hit signings that really weren't theirs, you know, and I was always terribly conscientious in that respect. I wish I hadn't been. I'd have earned a lot more money.
Well, you still had an amazing career. I mean, so... You
know. I've been very fortunate. I've had a marvellous time, and, you know, I've been fortunate to move from, you know, music to feature films to television, and to just keep it all moving, and it's been really exciting and fun. Whereas if you stay in the same business, you get to be paid more, but you have to do the same thing every week, you know. And I moved to America to work with John Hughes, and I came back 20 years later, and some of the people I'd hired when I was at Arista and WEA were now running the industry, head of Universal, Lucien Grange, and Max Hull running Universal, and you know, I went to see them and earning a fortune, but they, in that 20 years, every Monday they'd had to do the same chart meeting where they sat and talk about what records were in the charts this week, and I was thinking, boy, I'm glad I didn't do that. You know, I got to make films with John Hughes and work with John Candy and go live in America and work for Fox, and which was both interesting and awful. So, you know, it's been fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. I'm wondering, with A&R, obviously you are deciding, like you're saying, you're sitting there listening, is this band or artist going to make it or not, and am I going to put the record company behind them? It's terribly subjective. So there must be an element of huge self-confidence as an A&R person, in your own opinion. Where does that come from?
I suppose so. You know, if you grow up in, you know, again, if you're lucky to grow up in London just when the swinging 60s hit, you feel yourself to be in the epicenter of what's happening.
Yes.
And that's what gave me the confidence to say, no, this is happening, that's not happening.
Yeah.
Because it's what I grew up with. But what's, you know, in retrospect, when I look at A&R, spotting talent is not hard. You go to a gig, I mean, you go to a gig, Ruth, and you walk in and you go, oh, I like this. This is good.
Uh-huh.
This singer is singing to me. I'm engaged. I'm watching. And it's not hard to spot talent or non-talent. You walk into the gig and you're like, go get a drink. But knowing whether that talent wants to be successful, that's the unknown factor. And you only find that out once you start to work with them.
Right.
You know, I had to pass on U2 because I'd just been made head of A&R. I needed a hit record straight away. Otherwise, your career can be incredibly short.
Yeah.
So I went to see U2 and I thought, you know, good manager, great band, good songs, but there's no hit single on this first album. It's going to be a couple of albums before they break.
Yeah.
And I can't afford that. You know, I need something to happen straight away. And so I went after the Stray Cats instead, who delivered a hit straight away and, you know, cemented my career. But Bono had this desire to be successful and a work ethic that's just incredible and has, of course, propelled into international stardom. And when you meet people like Bono or Elton John or Sting, it, you know, this work ethic, this desire to be successful is marvelous. And so many artists that you sign just self-sabotage themselves.
Yes. Yeah, you see that so often. And I think it's a really different thing, like you say, having artistic talent and then also having that kind of drive to succeed, and a lot of artists don't have that. It seems like they're kind of mutually exclusive.
Well, yeah, that's right. And worse, I mean, one of the artists I was most proud to work with was the Associates, Billy McKenzie from Scotland, and committed suicide.
Oh.
And I mean, that self-sabotage in the extreme. But it's, you know, people either want to succeed or they are, you know, tortured artists, and you want to try and find the ones that are artists who want to succeed.
Right. Yeah. There's the knack.
You know.
Yeah.
But that's almost luck of the draw, because how do you know until you work with them and spend time with them?
Yeah.
Etc.
Which brings me to another question I wanted to ask you, is that, you know, A&R used to mean finding a talented artist and helping them to develop over usually several albums, whereas these days the development of artists by record companies is much more limited. I'm just wondering how you think that's affecting the quality of music that's in the mainstream.
Well, as with films, as with pop music, they're looking to hit things out of the ballpark straight away, and so it is all about, you know, appealing to the largest possible audience. That's why there's no risk. That's why there's no appealing to niches. That's why it's sort of blanding out in the middle with blockbuster movies about icons that you already know, or pop hits that are put together by teams that lack any sort of individual soul. That's not to say these movies aren't incredibly slick and you can sort of while away a couple of hours and it sort of washes over you and you're quite happy. Similarly with these, you know, hit records that are put together so perfectly, but they don't connect with your soul and they don't, you don't identify with them. Mm. I mean, the example I always remember was, you know, being, as I mentioned earlier, a bit of a hippie. when Easy Rider came out, you were blown away because there on the silver screen was your life, you felt this huge connection that your life was being portrayed on screen. Or similarly, you know, if a lyric of something you were listening to on the radio talked about, you know, hitchhiking across America as Simon and Garfunkel did, and you thought, yes, that I've done that. That's my life, and it really made you connect. And sadly, I think, you know, that's not so likely these days with the manufactured dance music. I mean, I think it's why rap connected so powerfully in America, because the lyrics did talk to a huge segment of the audience about a life that they recognized and they respond.
And I think that's still true. I mean, I think that, I mean, obviously, like every area of music, there is the commercialized element. But I think in rap and hip hop, you still have some really interesting artists saying some interesting things.
I agree. And I think country music also. You know, I find you can listen to country and you go, yeah, there's my life. There's my ex-wife driving away with my house.
Or my ex-husband, should be fair.
Or my ex-husband, he said bitterly. So yes, I think, you know, I do think, you know, art still has that ability to show us our lives. And if you can look at your life removed from that remove, you learn something.
Yes, yeah. I mean, what I see is that... because of the change, you know, to this sort of digital element that makes it so much easier to make good quality music and to get it out there, is that there are still some very interesting artists, but they're so niche, you know, they may have a few thousand followers or whatever. Yeah. And so we're not getting that common experience that we used to have, like, you know, where everybody loved Led Zeppelin, you know, or whatever. I'm not sure if we'll ever really have anything like that again, you know, where sort of everybody is really sharing in one experience of an art.
I think it's very unlikely. You know, the history of media is that it fractures.
Right.
It is in the nature of it. You know, from in England, two television channels to now, you know, innumerable TV channels from... it's what happens, and it becomes ever more niche, and there is a drive by the corporations to be ever more mainstream, and that's the conflict. But yeah, it goes in cycles, and you know, hopefully somebody will step in and, you know, start the more interesting cycle again at some point.
Yeah. You dealt with some very different bands at the same time. I'm looking at, like, the Simple Minds, Thompson Twins, Elaine Page. How do you do that when they're, you know, they're very different musically? You just having to adjust for each one in how you're developing them?
Yes, and you apply sort of certain business values to them as a head of A&R. You know, you look at how much they're costing you and how much the return is, and you make those sort of business judgments. Mm. And certainly some people are better at with certain sorts of music. Again, Clive Davis was so good with the sort of the girl singers that and that, you know, that that's was his sort of forte. It was a great privilege to work with all sorts of different sorts. But you know, at the time, you sort of thought certain bands were incredibly hip and they're the ones that you wore the T-shirt of.
I'm wondering, you've been responsible for helping develop the careers of some really, really big names in the music industry, but I'm wondering whether there were acts you believed in who were wonderful, but for whatever intangible reason didn't make it, and you know how you sort of come to terms with that. Did that happen?
You mean, were there acts that I championed and
yes.
they didn't?
Yeah.
Well, yes. I mean, I thought that Echo and the Bunnymen were going to be bigger than U2. I mean, I thought their music was similar in sound, and that they could step up to be a stadium act. But you know, for whatever reason, it never happened. And you know, there are moments. I mean, with the Beat, who I signed and who I still work with to this day, and I'm a huge fan of all the band
Beat.
Members.
Oh, such
but,
good
you know,
band.
They all, but you know, we started to have success. It was time to go to America, and the certain band members were like, nope, don't want to go to America, don't want to go on tour. That's not what we want to do. And you know, it's incredibly frustrating. The door is open, you know, to move from being selling 500,000 to selling a million or 2 million. But some people, you know, their lifestyle, what they want to do, is more important. And of course, at the time, I wanted to kill them. but in retrospect, you know, who am I to tell them how they should live their life? And if they don't want to go on the road in America, that's their choice. But it drives you mad.
Yeah.
I mean, and the Associates, you know, they were on Top of the Pops, they had the hit record, and the next day they phoned me up and were starting a tour, and they, you know, it primed to be such a huge act, and they phoned up and said, "We've split up, we're not going on tour."
Oh my
goodness.
And
my whole world sort of, my whole world crumbled, you know, and my career went down the gurgler. With that decision. I mean, they took me down because, you know, you need a constant supply of huge successes if you want to stay as the head of A&R, because people are paying you for your taste and for your ability to choose hits. And if there are no hits, you're pretty soon, you're heading out the door.
Yeah, it's pretty brutal, A&R, I think, isn't it? It really is. You're only as good as your last hit. Yeah.
Well, and, you know, whether you're choosing hit acts or you're choosing hit TV shows or choosing which films to go into production, it's the same pressure.
Yeah. Well, if you just joined us, you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts, Tarquin Gotch. We're going to a break now, but we'll be back after these messages.
Did you know about the Santa Cruz Art League on Broadway in Santa Cruz? Founded in 1919, it's 96 years young and provides a wonderful gallery space for local and national artists. It's a great place to view art with 14 shows a year and also to gain support if you're an artist yourself. There are art classes and weekend workshops, many taught by open studio artists. If you become a member, you receive a newsletter, discounts on classes, gifts and exhibit entries, images of your art on the Art League website, and guaranteed participation in the annual members show. It's also a great place to meet artists. Visit the Santa Cruz Art League at 562 Broadway or the website at scal.org. That's scal.org.
This portion of the show is sponsored by Dina Scopatoni, who is an award-winning fashion model, academic teaching modern art history at Cabrillo College, and Vogue fashion photographer. An ocular centrist, Dina's photographs range from fashion editorials to soul-catching portraits to evocative documentary images. The vibrant nature of her work evokes the glamour of Mario Testino, Annie Leibovitz, and Helmut Newton, while expressing an understanding of composition and contrast which is all her own. Trained as an art historian at the University of London's esteemed Courtauld Institute, Dina Scopatoni looks for the intellectual and visual contrasts in each of her photographs. If you're interested in viewing her wonderful work, you can go to dinascopatoni.com. That's dinascopatoni.com. Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts, Tarquin Gotch. I wanted to ask you, Tarquin, working with the director, John Hughes, you sort of coalesced your music world with the film world in music supervision. I'm wondering if you can tell us what exactly that involves and how you go about choosing music for films. I imagine that's quite fun.
It's fun and nerve-wracking. I mean, it is in simple terms. We used to go around to John's house. He was an inveterate cigarette smoker and coffee drinker and would stay up all night. And we would go around to his house and just try different pieces of music against picture. So there would be a sequence that needed music, and you would just play records against picture until we found something that was that really worked. What's important is that you go around to the house with the right records, that you have a selection and you find things that you feel will work. And you know, John was a huge Anglophile, and you know, here I am an A&R man from England and the manager of the Beat, and, you know, without wishing to sound cocky, you know, not unhip, and it's exactly what he wanted. So it was a marvellous match, but it was, you know, he was a genius. He was so good at making these things work. Yeah, it was a great privilege.
I mean, it always seems to me, as a music supervisor, you've just got this, like, I mean, the whole world of music. How do you kind of, like, start?
Narrow it down.
You know? Yeah, narrow it down, exactly.
Well, John would say, I need something for this sequence, and you'd say, is it action-packed? Well, that means up-tempo. Is it happy, sad? You know, and you get some key pointers, and so I would know to come to the house with, you know, a bunch of sad records or a bunch of happy records, a bunch of fast records, you know, and so you narrow it down. And you're not looking at the, for Planes, Trains and Automobiles, which is one of the films I'm most proud to have my name on, because I just love it. The first thing we did was we did a country and western soundtrack. And we went to Nashville, and we got all sorts of marvelous people to make tracks for us. And then when we tested the film, the country music just wasn't playing with the audience. It made it too country, and they felt removed from the film. And we had to take out a huge amount of that music and replace it with more... I'm going to say urban, but not urban in the modern sense of urban music, but, you know, city music. So that there was a balance, because this was a film about, you know, traveling from city to city. It wasn't a movie about just being in the country.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, you have to get the sort of genre right. And we got it wrong that time and upset all sorts of people in Nashville.
Oh, no.
Which I feel bad about to this day. I've never been back.
Oh, no. Oh, they've probably got long memories as well, I bet.
Oh, I'm sure they have. But, I mean, fortunately, a couple, you know, with the Steve Earle track stayed in and the Emmylou Harris track stayed in, and it was a huge... it was just great to work with, you know, people like that.
Yeah, yeah. In the 1990s, you moved into film production, running Hughes Entertainment and then Fox Circle Productions. How different did the film world feel compared with the music industry?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a challenge, obviously, to make that jump. Working for John Hughes... and running Hughes Entertainment out of Chicago, the deal was I had to move to Chicago. But he was such a powerhouse that, you know, when you called and you said, well, it's Tarkin, I'm running Hughes, and, you know, your phone calls were answered, people want to be in business with you. So, it you know, in some ways it was not as hard as it might seem. Mm. You know, I think starting a small... If you left the record business and started a small film company with no name, that would be really hard. But for me, it was a steep learning curve, but I would be a liar if I said it was really, really hard, because you had the Hughes brand at your back.
Mm, yeah, it makes sense. Film producing always seems such a mystery to me. There's so many different aspects to it and different prefixes to the title of producer. What part do you enjoy about it, and what is your focus with your producing?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, producer, like the word love or God, you know, is open to all sorts of interpretation. and you know, there are that many different sorts of producers. There's the producers that sort of organize the money. There's the producers that bring talent. There's the writer-producer. There's the famous actor-producer. You know, there's so many different sorts. What I was doing for John was making sure that his vision was being delivered. And in a very, very simple terms, that meant that, you know, shoot the script. Shoot what John's written. And then if there's still time during the day, by all means try whatever you want, but shoot the script. And I think because he was primarily a writer, that was his focus.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
So that was the sort of producer I was. That was it.
I mean, in terms of shooting the script, that means, you know, having a certain element of control. And so does that involve also who you're getting the money from for the film?
Well, again, you know, it's, you know, the first film I produced, the executive producer is my credit, was Home Alone. Mm. And I was working with Chris Columbus. And I stepped in, you know, the film was already prepping, and, you know, and it went on to be this, you know, a huge success. And I go, oh, well, this is fun. This is good. the next three films I executive produced for John, none of them really performed. And, you know, you learn so much more from the mistakes than you do from the successes.
Right.
So... Yeah.
you manage Brian Johnson of AC/DC, and you're currently executive producing the documentary series Cars That Rock with him. I'm wondering what it's like working for him, or with him rather, sorry.
It is an absolute blast. He is a very funny man, and if we had the finance, I would just roll camera on Brian all day and all night, because he is an incredibly funny man, and he's a charmer. And it's—I haven't had as much fun making television as I have with Brian. I mean, partly because he's getting to do something he loves. You know, I was very lucky when I met Brian. he was sitting around waiting for the Black Ice tour, and had been sitting around waiting for it for quite a while. And I said, look, what, you know, what's your passion in life? And he said, well, cars. And, you know, and I said, yes. And, you know, how many have you got? Oh, about 10. I said, well, why don't we write a book called, and it ended up being called Rockers and Rollers. And I said, each chapter is a car. It's, you know, because, you know, you remember all the cars that you've ever owned, and I bet you've got a story to go with it. And that's how we started. And we did the book, and that led to this TV show. And he is passionate about cars. He just loves them. Mm. And when you're working with somebody who's doing something they love, guess what? It's fun.
Yes, yeah.
It's, and really what he's doing with it, don't tell anybody, audience, please don't tell anybody, but what he's really doing is he's shopping. You know, we've done 12 cars, and we've done 12, you know, because each show is a different car, and we've done 12 cars. He's bought three. So, you know, I realized that, you know, really I'm just facilitating Brian going, you know, testing cars and then buying them. So the most recent is a Richard Petty Mustang that he's just bought. So, you know, and that's the first American car he's bought for I think ever, actually.
Oh, interesting. And so
I tell a lie, he bought a Hummer once and realized what a terrible mistake it was.
Well, I'm glad that he realized that. I would be disappointed in him otherwise.
I know. He said, why did I have one of my things? Why did I buy it? Anyway, never mind that.
Maybe he was just buying into the apocalyptic, you know, vision for a minute.
You know, yes, I think he got carried away. He was, at the time they'd made AC/DC had done the soundtrack to an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie.
Mm.
And Arnold, I think, had turned up in one. And I think, you know, I think it had impressed Brian on the day. But, you know, having to fill it up, he's, you know, Brian is very economically minded. And I think the constant trips to the gas station wore him down.
Yes. That's funny. So you had a lot of fun with him working on this. When can we see it in America? Is it out yet or is it finished?
It's the first, the second series has just is currently on air at the moment. Every episode has been on against some sort of massive election programming.
Yeah, right.
I mean, literally the last episode went out at the same time as the election results. And
it was
like, oh, my heaven. But fortunately, in today's television, you know, fewer and fewer people are watching on the night, and more and more are watching on catch-up, as they call it.
Yeah, or curating what they're watching.
That's right. They record it on their box, or they watch it on the computer or whatever. They don't watch it on the night at the time. Because when I got my overnights, I thought, oh, that's it. My career in television is over again. But then when we got the catch-ups, they were spectacular. But, you know, it's... So to answer your question, Discovery, I think, is looking at having it on air in America at the end of this year. It would not surprise me if they did it when AC/DC are on tour in America late this year.
It
wouldn't
makes sense.
Take a marketing genius to figure that one out. So, but I haven't been given an exact date, so that's why you're hearing a slight reticence in my voice, because I don't want to say something and then have it be wrong. But I would be very surprised if it's not on air around the AC/DC tour.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we can look out for that then. Cars That Rock.
Cars That Rock with Brian Johnson.
Now, you've spent a lot of your career facilitating artists to get their work out into the world. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of business acumen associated with that, but also a lot of creativity. I'm wondering whether you see that as an art. Do you see that as artistic in yourself?
Well, I think, you know, helping people do what they're good at is I suppose it's a gift. It's funny, as you asked the question, I was sort of thinking, I don't know. It is part of the artistic process, and there have been enough examples in history of the business entrepreneur making the difference. I was thinking of recently the stories about Van Gogh's brother was supporting his artistic process and etc. So I suppose it's important, but I always sort of feel if it's not me, it would be somebody else, you know, because there is. I see myself as a businessman. Really, ultimately, that's what I do. Is I'm in business.
Yes, but you're in a business full of creativity. So I'm assuming you must have some passion around the arts.
Oh yes, I think it goes back to growing up in the 60s and not wanting to be part of the establishment. You know,
right.
It just never occurred to me to go get a job in a bank or a corporation, though having said that, of course, I ended up, working for corporations, like Warner Records and Arista and then Fox and et cetera. But, the idea of staying in a corporation and sort of working your way up was never on the agenda. I always thought, well, you work for these people, you do whatever you're going to do, and then you move on. And you keep moving, and you... And I still feel the same today, I'm thrilled to be working in television in the UK at this point, but, 5 years from now, could be something else.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you obviously have incredible drive and interest in what you're doing that's, moving you forward into these new areas.
Yes. Yeah, I'm curious. And, I was just about to say, in 5 years it could be doing YouTube stories or where video games are going is extraordinary. Who knows where it's going to go. Who would have thought that television would be the sort of the superior art form over film, but one's definitely sensing that it is now.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your wonderful career with us, Top, and I really appreciate it, and it's just exciting to think that you have just done so much and helped so many great artists get out there.
Well, Ruth, thank you so much for having me on your show. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland. Remember, you can go to the website, itsaquestionofbalance.com, and hear all my past podcasts. If you enjoyed the show today, tell your friends about it. Tell them to go to the website and have a listen. See you next week.